The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, equipping and supporting New York's startup business community with Mac repairs and upgrades, on-site setup and support, free seminars and events, equipment rentals, sales, consultation, and more. Studio.techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. How do you prepare a nation for radical changes to come? How do you prepare a nation to adopt a mission that clarifies the values and freedoms of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution when you know there's rough waters coming ahead? Franklin Delano Roosevelt attempted to do just this in January of 1941. In a prolonged State of the Union address, which was FDR beginning to articulate an argument for America's involvement in World War II. The speech became the Four Freedoms Speech.
In the future days that we seek to make secure, we look forward to a world founded upon four essential human freedoms. The first is freedom of speech and expression. Everywhere in the world. The second is freedom of every person to worship God in his own way. Everywhere in the world. The third, freedom from want. The fourth is freedom from fear.
The speech was a success and began to shape the inevitability of an ambivalent America joining another war overseas. But all that was cast aside when America entered World War II after the Japanese surprise attack on Pearl Harbor 11 months later. Freedom from fear became something else. Franklin Roosevelt died on this day in 1945, and all this week we are looking at the four freedoms and where they stand today. How did the war change and twist their meanings? Which freedoms are most in need of vigilance? Joining us to talk about this fascinating and not often told story of American history is Harvey Kay, professor of democracy and justice at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, and author of The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great. Professor Kay, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be talking with you.
How do we evaluate the four freedoms both before and after Pearl Harbor?
The first thing to understand is that when Roosevelt was articulating, was that he's expressing and laying out the four freedoms back in January of 1941, he has various things on his mind. First of all, he has in mind the idea that the United States can become the arsenal of democracy. The Four Freedoms speech back in January of 41 actually was the call to arms for Americans. I mean, Roosevelt had no doubt that the Germans or the Japanese were going to make an attack on the United States somewhere. And his idea was, now was the time to bolster American support for the British. So this was a speech in which the opening many paragraphs really deal with the imperative of creating defense industries, expanding them, and becoming the arsenal of democracy. But then he says that it requires more than arms. And he now moves into a sort of moment where he's going to offer a vision of the world beyond the war. And he, first of all, recalls the New Deal and the imperative not to sacrifice or give up what America was about during those 8 years fighting the Depression. And then he moves into the four freedoms, the freedom of speech, freedom of worship, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. And he spoke of them decidedly in international terms, in global terms. Though strangely enough, when Americans were listening to him, they heard it just as much as a statement of these are the freedoms we will continue to pursue in the future, and they weren't thinking exactly of the global. And then, of course, Pearl Harbor. This is what Americans will be fighting for.
I'm surprised that after Pearl Harbor, the struggle for those freedoms becomes very much an internal battle, even though we are fighting around the world for freedom for every person in the world and a freedom of speech for every person in the world, freedom of worship for every person in the world. I don't know about the prosperity thing. That's a hard one. But the freedom from fear, it seems as though America feared the Japanese so much that they were willing to toss the idea of freedom out by putting the Japanese in internment camps.
Yeah, I mean, there's the tragic side of the Roosevelt years, and the tragic side includes the fact that the State Department did everything in its power to block Jewish refugees from making it into the United States. The fact that when the war began, Roosevelt allowed his military advisors and California politicians to have him sign the executive order, which moved Japanese Americans from the West Coast into internment camps in the Far West and the Midwest. And of course, the third element is the fact that he allowed his military advisors to talk him into a Jim Crow army in which white troops and African American troops are separated into different units. And yet, isn't it funny to think that when those four freedoms are proclaimed, those four freedoms become not simply a white slogan, they become the slogan, indeed, of all Americans.
And 75 years later, how are those four freedoms?
Well, I always tell people that right now it seems at least one party in our two-party system seems to be cultivating freedom to fear as opposed to freedom from fear.
RBK is professor of democracy and justice at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. He's author of The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Five to 70% of Republicans recognize that nominating Donald Trump would be a disaster and hands the general election to Hillary Clinton.
I say this to the RNC and I say it to the Republican Party. You're going to have a big problem, folks, because there are people that don't like what's going on.
At the end of the day, I'm the only person who consistently beats Hillary Clinton in the fall.
If we can unite those 65 to 70% of Republicans, we win.
Well, it's not her party these days, and she's not crying about it all, but Christine Todd Whitman was governor of New Jersey from 1994 to 2001 and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency administrator under President George W. Bush from 2001 to 2003. She's now president of the Whitman Strategy Group. She's here to talk about the campaign, and she's here to talk about formulating policy in the midst of all the chaos. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Governor Whitman.
Good to be with you.
Donald Trump could be the nominee of the GOP. I mean, it's looking like a contested convention, but but in theory, he could be the nominee. If that is the case, would that mean the end of the GOP as you know it? And if so, where would you go?
Well, I think it would mean that we would lose big time and lose down ballot. I mean, it could lose the House, lose the Senate, certainly, and probably lose a lot of the municipal because the American people are in the center and they want someone who can really run, I mean, the country. And not just going to bluster their way there. I mean, he has tapped into a real fear and a real anger amongst people, but that's not the way to bring the people of the country together. And that's not the way to make it function, and it's not the way to deal with the rest of the world. Where do I go? I don't know. I have to stay and to see what's going on. I'll always stay involved in policy. I care too much about this country. I love it. And all that we have, all that we are, all that we stand for the rest of the world, we are a beacon of hope. There is a reason why people are trying to come to this country as much as they are. And we've got to remember that, feel good about that, but live up to those ideals.
Can you see yourself a member of another party? The Whigs became the Republicans.
Yeah, right. Well, the Republicans, yeah. Republicans started as a third party. Who knows? Who knows?
How do you reconcile the let's get back to issues with the party's self-destruction?
Well, that's why I'm a supporter of John Kasich, because he's the only one who's talking about the issues and not screaming and yelling and taking extreme positions or trying to instill fear in people so we can have a conversation. That's the only way you're going to do it, if you're going to have a conversation. But as you know, primaries, unfortunately, are not usually about the issues. That comes in the general. And yet that's exactly what people should be looking for, especially now, given the state of the country. We need to have we need to know where people stand, what they're going to do about the issues. I can't find a position of Trump's. I don't really know. I haven't seen Cruz having actually been able to come forward with accomplishments in his time in the Senate, other than shutting down the government. That's why I look at somebody like Kasich, who has actually been there, done that successfully.
At a convention, a contested convention, how do you make the argument for Sorry, Donald, you didn't make it. Sorry, Mr. Cruz, you're just too extreme. We're going to give it to Kasich.
Well, it's not going to be we're going to give it. The delegates are going to decide that. If it gets to a second or third ballot, they're going to start looking for who can win in the best interest of the party and the country. And that's where I think, I mean, my ideal ticket is a Kasich Rubio.
The president has really pushed sustainable energy and green jobs and all of those issues throughout his presidency, to some extent to no avail because the Congress has resisted him. Mm-hmm. What would you want to see as an energy policy, a coherent energy policy for the United States?
Well, first of all, I'd like it to be pretty simple. I would like it to say we want clean, green, reliable, affordable energy, and then get out of the way and let the marketplace make the decisions. If you make that, because that's what we want. We want a healthy environment. We want the quality of life that comes from that. And then you bring in things like nuclear. If you look at the green energy, the renewable energies are great, but they're only about 11% of our overall energy mix today. And we're looking at a 22% increase in electricity demand by 2040. You're not going to be able to ramp those up to meet that. Plus the fact that they only work when the weather conditions are favorable. They all the renewables now have to have base power backup, and that's fossil fuel, and those are dirty. And when you look at nuclear, it's the only form of power that releases no greenhouse gases or other regulated pollutants when it's producing power, and it has an enormously good safety record here in this country. Operates at about in last year, they operated at 91% efficiency, the reactors around the country. It's a huge job creator. And even if we don't bring on any new nuclear power, the rest of the world is, and it can create jobs here in this country. We can do manufacturing again. You know, we're pretty good at that.
Political viability for large-scale nuclear development in the East, particularly?
We've got five being built now. One is the TVA, at the TVA, which should come on this year. And then you have two in Georgia, two in South Carolina that will be in between 2019 and 2020. And then they're looking at two more in South Carolina and two more in Florida. And there are other parts of the state. Wisconsin just repealed a law that would not have allowed any new nuclear. Because as people look at those who believe in climate change and others who just want clean air, they're looking at how do you do that without nuclear? I mean, you really can't get to what we have committed to, at least verbally, on the COP21, that Paris meeting. You can't get there without nuclear. You can't get the clean air.
That's why the French got to their target, is because of nuclear.
Yes, exactly.
And Christine Todd Whitman was governor of New Jersey and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency administrator under President George W. Bush. She's now president of the Whitman Strategy Group and co-chair of the Clean and Safe Energy Coalition. Got a couple conversations this hour about recycling, but here's an unusual one. You want to recycle that old crop duster plane you've got parked in your field out back? Eric Prince, you know, that law is no impediment entrepreneur who started the now defunct Blackwater Group, he can help. Prince has also got an enticing offer for a small country dictator to keep his people in line. Prince suggests one of the cheapest ways to terrify and render docile your unruly people is to buy a fleet of his small retrofitted armored aircraft that can kill from above. Prince is doing it by retrofitting crop duster planes made in America with military technology purchased from around the world. It's a fascinating, terrifying story. And we turn back to investigative journalist from The Intercept, Matthew Cole, to pick up the story.
You know, one source that we spoke to said, quite frankly, that if Prince's vision had been implemented in any of the African countries that he was trying to sell it, it would have worked, that on the continent of Africa in particular, these kinds of planes could defeat any nation-state army. I mean, the militaries on that continent are not that robust, and there certainly are few, not many, air forces. And so putting this into place in places like Libya, where he offered it, South Sudan, you know, Nigeria, it would have been devastating. And of course, with anything that goes into mercenary or private military, there's the question of accountability. When things go wrong, how do you hold anyone responsible? And I think it's clear with these kinds of planes, there were going to be things that go wrong.
Why is Prince so committed to this idea of selling Air Force, Ground Force, and in fact a whole military operation as a product. You know, it goes beyond just simple mercenaries. He's actually he's selling the Battle of Guadalcanal.
There are a few things that come up when you talk to the people who've known him over the years. The first is that as someone who had a very short career inside the Navy SEAL teams who didn't deploy during a war, he has made it very clear to other people around him that he is eternally sorry that he was not able to deploy in a conflict. Part of it is, secondly, is that he is an entrepreneur and a businessman like his father. And what he's done is he's found a way in the world of militaries fighting to buy into, with his wealth, the entire ecosystem of services. And he's bought into an entire supply chain so that if and when he's successful in selling a proposal, he owns a cut or a piece of nearly everything that gets delivered in terms of goods and services into a war or a conflict.
So his business is freedom from fear. He's selling fear.
If you've watched his career over 10 or 15 years, what starts out as the, you know, uber patriot, you know, the person who's trying to support the American cause in Afghanistan and Iraq, has slowly turned into some kind of Frankenstein-like justification for the things he's done, including working with the Chinese government. Not that there's anything wrong with working with the Chinese government, but certainly communist government there is not, you know, not a close partner of American causes. And gone around the world making very interesting friends and associates, including the arms dealer that supplied Victor Boot for his efforts to sell weapons around the world. And he's painted himself in a corner is what's happened. He has fewer and fewer friends. And one of the things that we, my colleague Jeremy Scahill and I, discovered was that over 10 years, very few people who go into business with him end up feeling good about it. They generally regret having to be associated because he is fairly impetuous. And while he has a very bright mind for how a war can be fought or maybe should be fought, he is not a great businessman in terms of how he applies himself. And he burns a lot of bridges.
Mm. What do you think his dream is in terms of a conflict around the world right now? Of getting on the phone and saying, I can take care of this. Give me full autonomy. I'll go in and do this.
Well, we can say from seeing several of his proposals for Africa and the Middle East that he believes that he can bring in what he calls turnkey solutions. That's a phrase that you see over and over in his documents, where he can provide a ground force, special operations ground force, a special operations air force, these planes that don't need to fly above 4,000 or 5,000 feet that can drop bombs, rockets, and can turn the tide against any conflict that is being fought against, insurgencies or terrorist groups that have small arms. Certainly, he believes that he has the solution to rid the continent of Africa of the scourge of Islamic terrorism or Islamic radicals.
Matthew Culls, an investigative journalist for The Intercept, to the further adventures of Mr. Arik Prince, founder of Blackwater, who is very much at work trying to create a small turnkey air force and ground force for small conflicts around the world. Matthew, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
What freedom do you care most about and why? Doug from San Diego, California. I was a U.S. Marine infantry officer for 25 years, and early in my career, I put copies of Norman Rockwell's paintings depicting the four freedoms on my wall to remind me of why I served. Monticello, New York. It's all an illusion. Everything comes at a cost. The real question would be, what is one willing to sacrifice to attain this so-called illusion of freedom of speech and worship from want and fear? As we evolve, we need to think past all these, and yet here we are, mulling about existing and not thriving.
Hi, this is Heidi from Chicago. The freedom that I'm most concerned about is the freedom of fear. I fear not having good health care, especially since I struggled with cancer a few years ago. I fear not finding a good job, and I generally have fear of the uncertainty in my life. And I would really like freedom from all those fears.
Kate from South Carolina. And while freedom of speech might be what our country was founded on, I think freedom from want is what's most important in our society today when we have so many impoverished families around the country.
8778-MY-TAKE is our number. Comment at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org. And LegalZoom, supporting small business owners across America for over 10 years. With services including business formations and corporate filings, plus independent professionals providing contract review and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
Recycling is one of the so-called green job creators. As cities adopt recycling and as manufacturers purchase recycled raw materials, the recycling game has grown to become a $90 billion industry in the United States. If you just include scrap, that translates to 135 million metric tons of materials in the waste stream annually. Working in a scrapyard can be dangerous, though. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, 313 workers at scrapyards and sorting facilities were killed on the job from 2003 to 2014. Many of those employees work heavy machinery with little training, and some are receiving less than minimum wage for their labor. Brian Joseph is a staff reporter for Fair Warning, a nonprofit news organization that focuses on public health, safety, and environmental issues. Joseph says in this new industry called recycling, rules and regulations are hard to come by.
I think the two that stand out for me are scrap yards. Those are places where people will drop off, you know, say metal, for example, or sorting facilities that take the contents of your blue bin that you put to your curbside, and then they go through and separate out the paper, plastic, metal, and wood. Those are particularly hazardous because you have a fast-moving conveyor belt with, you know, lots of material. The people by hand have to go through and figure out where they need to go.
Are people in suits when they're handling this material? Are they gloved? Do they have hard hats, that sort of thing?
Yeah, gloves, vests, that sort of thing. But, you know, I spoke with one recycling worker, sorting facility worker. You know, he said this colleague of his, you know, picked up a broken television and it cut right through the colleague's leather padded gloves. You know, just because there's some safety components there doesn't mean that it's really ensuring the worker's safety.
What was the most difficult a scary job you saw at one of these scrap yards?
Well, my piece is built around a particularly dramatic case that occurred in Atlanta a few years ago, and that involved a 19-year-old undocumented worker who was working at a metal recycling facility, and he went about pushing some scrap metal that had gathered on the ground with a loader. And there was some gasoline on the ground, and his loader caught fire, and he was burned to death inside the loader.
What federal oversight is there on these facilities, and how quickly have they grown and outstripped the ability of OSHA and other federal regulators to maintain a good eye of what's going on?
Well, recycling facilities are treated like any other work site. OSHA has very limited resources, and while recycling is on their radar, it is not one of their top priorities right now. So as a result, you know, they're just not sending a lot of resources towards these facilities.
There's a whole range of things that are recycled. Is it the case that recycling is essentially putting workers who are paid less than minimum wage into a toxic waste stream?
Specifically as it relates to electronic waste, computers, as well as batteries, can be particularly hazardous to people's health. There's a number of cases involving scrap yards where metal boxes or metal containers are brought in and, you know, a poor recycling worker is going to open it, maybe using a torch of some kind, and the container explodes because it contains chemicals that are explosive, maybe gunpowder, things of that nature.
How would you change the system other than just giving people a raise to make their job more attractive and to settle this question of what you think is a disparity between recycling workers and others regarding on-the-job safety?
I think the biggest issue here is one of awareness and one of getting employers to take this as a serious issue for them. And I think it's one in which, frankly, the government needs to do a better job of informing people about the importance of this issue.
Brian Joseph is a staff reporter with Fair Warning, a nonprofit news organization that focuses on public health, safety, and environmental issues. Brian, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
What is freedom?
Freedom of speech.
At this point, free speech is nothing more than a nuisance.
Freedom of worship.
Wake up, Christian America. You are being mocked.
Freedom from want.
We would actually go in Walmart and clean ourselves up before we go to
sleep. Yeah, in the bathroom.
Save someone.
Freedom from fear.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear.
Freedom from fear was one of the first casualties of World War II. Fear is where we begin our week-long examination of the state of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's four freedoms today. What Roosevelt didn't know in January of 1941 was that in under a year's time, the Japanese would attack Pearl Harbor, thrusting the United States into World War II.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
For Japanese American Setsuko Winchester, the infamy was how the United States turned on itself during World War II. She's a ceramicist and former NPR journalist, and as outraged as she is about the Pearl Harbor attacks, this freedom from fear has a deeply personal and painful connotation. After Pearl Harbor, Japanese Americans were rounded up and held in internment camps. Setsuko has been telling their story with handmade tea bowls, painted yellow, that she photographs at the sites of internment camps she's visited around the country. Setsuko says the bowls are her symbol of fear as a freedom promised and as a freedom withdrawn.
I think he thought that he was going to make America safe for Americans and that Americans deserve to be able to go to bed feeling safe within their homes. For example, that's the painting that's depicted in Norman Rockwell's painting in the Four Freedoms Rotunda in Stockbridge at his the Norman Rockwell Museum. When I go visit that painting, I think he did not mean it for me.
No.
And that freedom from fear meant freedom from me. That I'm what people were fearful of. Because if I was born, you know, in a different age, and it was 1942 today, I know that I would be the target of that fear. My family would be told to assemble at some racetrack and then sent in covered trains to someplace out in the middle of a desert and left there for 4 years. They would have lost their businesses and their homes, and no one would ever talk about it again.
Yeah. And the Japanese internment experience that you're describing there
mm-hmm.
is both a fear that motivated an extraordinary loss of freedom for American citizens, Japanese Americans in this case. And it raised the question of freedom from fear. What so many Americans fear is not something outside our borders, but fear of what the American government might do during this 2016 campaign. Are you having thoughts about that?
Yes, I think that it feels very, very similar. By 1942, most of them had been born there or had lived there for decades, and still they were considered foreigners. And I know today I'm still considered a foreigner. I'm not an American. Asians are not Americans. Asians are not part of the American story. They're almost invisible. And even the fact that Japanese internment happened is invisible. What part of my project was to visit the camps because I didn't learn about it growing up. And I finally decided when my husband, who's a writer, became an American citizen in 2011, I had to think about what it meant to be an American. Who's an American? You know, who belongs here and how long do you have to be here to be considered an American? And I realized that I had to find out my history. And my history is not being Japanese. My history is being Japanese American.
What do your
ceramics represent in this art project?
I'm a ceramicist, and I hand-pinch 120 tea bowls, and I glaze them various shades of yellow. And they're all different sizes, and they're supposed to represent people. I made 120 to represent 120,000 individuals that were incarcerated. Some were children. A lot of them were children. Some were mothers, fathers. They were just human.
Is it sensitive for you as a Japanese American to raise this issue? Have you heard from other Japanese Americans?
Well, I haven't really tried to tell anybody. I just started doing it for myself. It was just a personal response, and I decided I wanted to visit the camps, and people started asking about it and sort of taken on a life of its own, especially when I took it to the Four Freedoms Park in New York.
What was that like?
It was exhilarating in a way that I can look at the phrases that FDR wrote and show that I know I'm not part of it, and I don't see why.
It's an emotional issue.
Yeah, I think I've never really talked about it before, especially not publicly. And it's not something that you get taught in school. I know everybody says they're taught in school. A lot of people say that. But I also know a lot of people. I was out in L.A., and I asked all kinds of people, and a lot of them say, I've never heard of that. I didn't know that. And if they do learn about it, they say that it was inevitable, that the Japanese had to be put away. But I have to say the Germans weren't put away. Neither was the mayor of New York, who was Italian.
Is part of the message of your art project and the passion that you feel for all of this is that not even really FDR understood the vigilance that's required to preserve this of the four freedoms, this freedom from fear, and that's part of the statement you're trying to make?
Yes. I think FDR understood it, but I think that he had to do it. I think he was a politician, you know. Eleanor Roosevelt fought him. She's my hero. I think she really understands what America is about and stood up for it. But in the end, you know, she had to support her husband.
What do you think the message of these tea bowls is in thinking about freedom from fear in today's world?
I just want to remind people that, you know, fear is human. It's natural, but and I understand that. I understand that people are afraid, but that most human beings, and I truly believe this, want to cooperate. They'd rather build something together than to destroy things. And being Japanese, I think, you know, when you live in a country where there's so many earthquakes and tidal waves and tsunamis, and it's hard to build something together. Most people in America come here because they believe in America's message. And I do, too. I think that it's pretty amazing that people from all over the world, all kinds of religions, all kinds of ethnicities, can get together and create some place like New York and get along. And it's so magical and rich, and I hope that that doesn't have to die because people are afraid.
Setsuko Winchester, Japanese-American ceramicist, former NPR journalist, and a passionate artist. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can find our series on the Four Freedoms at thetakeaway.org/Four Freedoms. We've been hearing a lot from you on this series. What freedom do you care most about and why? From Worcester, Massachusetts, freedom to travel and explore safely with access to national parks and forests. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a brain training program, performance can be compared with global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com.
PRI, Public Radio International. At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.